Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The new year is only 2 weeks old, but for astronomers, it's already been spectacular. On January 1st, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft zoomed through the faraway region of our solar system known as the Kuiper Belt and encountered some intriguing distant objects. Then just a few days later, China announced it had landed a rover on the so-called dark side of the moon, with enormous implications for scientists in China and elsewhere. And speaking of the moon, get ready this weekend for an unusual lunar show, an eclipse of a special kind called a super blood wolf moon. Today in The Exchange, our team of astronomers is here to answer your questions about these and other stories, so let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. Mal, welcome back. Happy New Year. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us, John Gianforte, director of the UNH Observatory and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And John, good to see you too. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here too.
Also with us, Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. And Nicole, a big welcome. Thank you also for your time.
Thanks.
And let's start with the moon, super blood wolf moon. What could be more intriguing than that, John Gianforte? A lunar eclipse coming up Sunday night. What makes this one so special?
Well, lunar eclipses are pretty rare, even though we've had a couple. We actually had two last year that we should have been able to see at some point in North America. So they're pretty rare. They're beautiful. They're completely safe to look at. And when they happen, lots of people can see them. Unlike a solar eclipse, where you have to be in the path of totality to see a total solar eclipse, lunar eclipses are usually visible from a very wide geographic area. And that's the true for this eclipse. People in North America are perfectly positioned for this eclipse to see the whole eclipse. People in South America, parts of Africa, Europe, Middle East can see this eclipse. So the only problem, at least with New England, is the impending winter storm heading our way. But you never know when we could catch a break. So this is an eclipse, the total part of the eclipse, the most colorful part of the eclipse. And lunar eclipses can turn the moon a beautiful yellow, orange, sometimes red. That's where it gets the name blood moon.
Oh, okay. That's where it comes from. What about the wolf part?
Yeah, well, every month's full moon has a name. The Yule moon, the spring moon, the strawberry moon, the thunder moon. This one is the wolf moon. And that's just a cultural name. It doesn't affect what the whole world calls the moon, full moon for January.
I see.
It's just what we call it in North America. A super moon, another phrase coined by an astrologer, I hate to say, so I try not to use that word too much. Super moon means the moon is closer to Earth than normal, so it's a little bit bigger and a little bit brighter. But if you don't observe the moon regularly, you'd never know it.
Oh, really interesting.
Okay, hate to diffuse the beautiful adjective describing that. And actually, any excuse to make more people go out and look at a lunar eclipse.
Well, exactly. I mean, I might stay up a little bit late now that I know it's a super blood wolf moon. I mean, who knows? Nicole, what's the science lesson here? If you were watching this with your students, what would you tell them?
I like to focus on the color, that red color, because that comes from the fact that the Earth's sunlight is being refracted around the limb of the Earth. So, and I've heard it described, and I can't remember where I heard this from originally. It's the moon is reflecting back all of the light of all of the sunsets and all of the sunrises that are happening on Earth. So it's that reddish light that we get after the sunlight passes through the atmosphere. Most of the blue is scattered away. That red light gets bounced back off the moon's surface because the sunlight isn't shining directly on it. So
that's
we see that
really
red.
Interesting. So if there's a sunset going on somewhere... Mm-hmm. On some Pacific island somewhere or
all
wherever that's
all,
coming
that
back
ring,
to
yeah, that ring around the Earth where all the sunrises and sunsets are happening, that light is getting reflected back at us.
That's really cool.
For those of us that can see the eclipse.
How about you, Mel? What would you tell? You used to work with young kids at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center.
Well, this particular
what would you say?
Blood moon is a kind of a rarity because this is going to be the last one, the only one this year. And the next one that will be just like this or very close to it. This is more where the moon is dead center behind the Earth and the Earth blocking the sun. If you were on the moon and looking out at the Earth, you would see what we would see as a new moon type thing. It would just be totally dark. And you would see that ring that Nicole was talking about around the atmosphere. But the next time this type of moon is going to happen is not until May 26th of 2021. In between, there'll be other lunar eclipses, but they won't be as dark and red as this one will be. So because of the weather forecast, I have my fingers very much crossed.
Because there's some snow forecast, so it could be cloudy. We might not see it.
The latest I heard this morning was the weather guy on the TNV said that there's the way he described it was through most of the day on Sunday, I believe are the words he used. So I'm hoping that it will clear off because the deepest part of totality when it's exactly centered is a little after midnight on Sunday night into Monday.
Well, sure. So let's talk about that. So if you want to see it, John, what should you do?
Well, first of all, make sure it's clear. But the like Mal said, the greatest eclipse where the moon is closest to the center of the Earth's shadow is 12:13 a.m. on the 21st.
Okay.
It's actually technically Monday morning, but late Sunday night. So that's the best time to see it. However, the total phase of the eclipse begins at 11:41 and ends at 12:43. So it's a 62-minute length of totality where the moon is in the inner, darker, umbral shadow of the Earth. Now, the lunar eclipse that we had in July, the moon moved almost through the exact center of the Earth's dark shadow. So it was a dark, colorful eclipse. This one, the moon skirts toward the northern end, the northern edge of the shadow. So the top of the moon probably won't get as dark and as red and as orange as the center of the moon will. You'll notice it's brighter near the top. So between those hours of 11:41 and 12:43, that's the 62-minute long period of totality. And that's when you should go out and take a look.
Do you want to jump in, Nicole?
Yeah, so I'm. If it's clear, I will have something open on campus so that we can look at it. A lot of some sites will tell you when different phases of the eclipse start. So the penumbral eclipse starts at 9:36, and people go outside and they get really excited, and you can't really tell what's going on because the shadow is really faint. I think it starts to get interesting around 10:33. That's when it starts to go into partial eclipse, and you get to see the moon having chunks taken out of it over time. So if you stare at it, you're not going to see it happen in front of your eyes. But if you look back and forth every few minutes, you're going to notice it disappearing.
All right,
it's a great photo event. You can start taking pictures at you can start taking a few pictures at 10 o'clock, 10:30, take one every 15 minutes without moving your tripod, and you can actually see, you can actually craft a nice little time lapse to see how the moon changes as it enters the Earth's shadow.
Well, I have actually two more moon headlines that I want to ask both of you, all of you about, so I'm going to set this one aside for the moment, but invite listeners again to join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're taking your questions about some of the latest headlines already in this new year from the world of astronomy. You can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org.
at nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Olivia, I want to ask you about a headline that was huge, just a couple days into the new year. The Chinese government announced that they'd landed a rover on the so-called, I know you're not supposed to say this, dark side of the moon. Mal is wincing already. It's called Chang'e 4, the Chang'e part after the Chinese moon goddess, the 4 part built on the success of the Chang'e 3 lander, which touched down the moon in December of 2013. This was a huge topic. It was everywhere. Nicole, you first, but everybody, why was this so important?
So this landing was the first soft landing on what we call the far side of the moon. Dark side of the moon is what it's often called, but as my Astronomy 101 students find out in lab, there's no true dark side. Every piece of the moon pretty much sees sunlight at some time. But because the same side of the moon faces us, it's gravitationally locked. The far side, or the backside, is the side we never see from Earth. So they did a soft landing on the far side, which was a big deal. And it's doing some interesting science experiments. It has some collaborations with Germany and Sweden and a couple of other countries to have instruments on it. One is going to look at how the solar wind interacts with the lunar surface. And there's another one that I'm super excited about, a low frequency radio spectrometer. So like a test radio telescope, because being on the far side of the moon means you've blocked all of Earth's emissions, all of our, I know we're on the radio, we're guilty, all of our Wi-Fi signals, all of our
noise
radio signals.
From Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
All of that human made noise. So it's testing an idea which has been talked about for a while now about putting a radio telescope on the moon's far side.
What excited you about this, Mal?
I was intrigued by how they actually talk to the rover, because it's on the backside of the moon and you can't get a signal there, as Nicole just mentioned. So how do we keep track of what's going on and how does it communicate with Earth? And the way they do it is they have another satellite that's in a very interesting position. And the rest of you can help me fill this in, I think. But it's called a Lagrange point. And when you get to it's a particular point where the balance of gravity, is the way I understand it, is such that you can put something there and then make it go in a big circle at that point around an imaginary object, and it will just stay that way. So what they've done is they've got another spacecraft that is orbiting in a big circle that is outside of the diameter of the moon, so that it is always in touch from behind the moon at this Lagrange point, or L2, that it's always in contact with what's happening on the backside of the moon and relaying information back and forth.
So it can catch the data from
right.
the lander.
So imagine
that is
looking
there.
At the moon as we see it from Earth, and we would perceive, if you could find it, a satellite that's orbiting north to south around it and facing the Earth. So it's just above the surface of the moon so that they have a line of sight communication with the Earth.
Well, and from what I understand, John, this is the first time that anybody has landed something on this far side of the moon. I keep wanting to say dark side of the moon. Only the U.S. and the Soviet Union have ever landed spacecraft on the moon before. So this is a big, big deal for China.
It is a big deal. They're trying to make a statement. They're trying to gain preeminence in space. Everybody knows that in the space industry. And, you know, a lot of people are cheering them on because, you know, we know that this will get the U.S. government off its duff to fund research. And, oh, my gosh, we can't be showed up by the Chinese space program. We got to get going again. So, OK, let that be the source of some funding, at least. But give the Chinese their due. They did something that no one did before. And the reason why no one's landed on the far side is because it's difficult. And you have to have another relay piece of hardware. And that's money, complication. And I give them credit for going through all the rigor necessary to make this mission successful. And it's great to see the pictures of a part of the moon we've not seen before from the surface.
Besides street creds and science, what else is China's interest in doing this, John? I heard
One Chinese scientist say this side of the moon might have, quote, resources for future human exploitation. Are there minerals and stuff there that would be valuable?
I mean, there's minerals all over the moon, okay? And this is a tough part of the solar system to do work in because you're cut off from home, right? Except for relay satellites. Now, we've relayed in data from planetary surfaces back to Earth a lot. We did it at Saturn with Cassini. We do it at Mars all the time. We have lots of spacecraft that are active at Mars, and the spacecraft orbiting Mars take data from spacecraft on the surface, send them back to Earth. So it's not like this has never been done before, but we've never done it on the moon. So the resources on the moon, there certainly are resources, but I'm not sure mining the moon is on very many people's mind right now.
You know, Nicole, you mentioned one of the things that interested you about this Chinese moon landing. Something that attracted me to it was the lander includes a little biosphere with some plants, even some fruit flies. Anybody who saw the movie The Martian remembers how he plants potatoes on Mars. So this is just from Chinese media just recently. It says China successfully germinated a cotton seed on the far side of the moon, marking the first time any biological matter has been grown on the lunar surface. Now, again, it's in an airtight canister, just so to say, grown on the surface. To me, that implies it put down roots and lunar soil. That's not exactly accurate. But what do you make of this?
I just saw those pictures this morning on Twitter, actually. That's pretty exciting. I like the cool factor of microbes in space and plants in space and seeing how they react to a low-gravity environment. I think that the low-gravity environment probably is what you would get most useful out of that because it's not actually in the lunar soil itself. The regolith is super dry.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get to see how it works in 1/6 gravity.
Well, and you get bragging rights. You get to say,
remember what they said on the movie The Martian. Once you've grown crops somewhere, you've colonized it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Of course, there's no person there growing these crops, but okay. That's a stretch.
Well, really interesting. And again, listeners, if you want to ask us more questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So we've been talking about the moon. One more moon story that I did want to ask all of you about, and that is when the U.S. might return to the moon. John, you said, for example, this Chinese success might prompt the U.S. to quote you, get off its duff and go back to the moon. Let's hear what NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said about this, highlighting private sector partnerships for moon exploration. This clip, by the way, is from late November.
Not only are we announcing today a number of very innovative companies that are going to go to the moon for the first time commercially. In other words, we're going to buy the service. We're not going to purchase, own, and operate the hardware. We're going to buy the service. But we're also announcing a change that I think is important for NASA. And that is, this is a response to the science community, who has for a long time decided that we needed to do science on the surface of the moon, and yet NASA for a long time has focused the moon within the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate and not the Science Mission Directorate.
So we'll talk about this a lot more in a moment. But Mal, what's the case for going back to the moon? I mean, we've kind of been there a couple times already.
Well, we haven't been there since with humans since 1972 was the last landing of the Apollo program. But I guess the concept is, if you start off with small steps and you go to the moon first, you can then build a base there and do experiments and stuff to later get you to Mars. And that's kind of what the NASA director was talking about. He has 9 commercial companies lined up to do all the dirty work.
All right.
And get us there. SpaceX is one, Lockheed Martin's. Companies like that.
There's a lot more for us to talk about after a short break, but we're going to be completely predictable and go into the break playing Pink Floyd's album Dark Side of the Moon. So enjoy it. And when we return, your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. Join me and a panel of experts in Nashua for a conversation on New Hampshire's opioid crisis. As part of NHPR's Crossroad Reporting Project, we take stock of where the state is now with this epidemic and what the future might be. Join us at the Nashua Public Library on February 7th at 6:30 p.m. Get your free tickets at nhpr.org/events. This is The Exchange. Today, our Sky crew is here bringing us news from the cosmos. Some of the headlines we're covering: the Chinese landing of a craft on the far side of the moon. Also, American plans to return to the moon, this time with private contractors. And a little bit later, we'll talk about the New Horizons spacecraft flyby of the most distant object ever encountered, 4 billion miles away. We'd love your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center, Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College, and John Gianforte, director of the UNH Observatory and astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And all of you, the moon has occupied a lot of our conversation today, and that's really interesting, both with the Chinese spacecraft, that super lunar eclipse we talked about earlier. But just before the break, we were talking about American plans to go back to the moon. John Gianforte, Mal explained that this is different because we're going to be contracting with lots of private companies. Also, we haven't been there in a long, long time, so science has evolved. What are your interests in terms of going back to the moon?
Well, I think the takeaway from this story is we're going back to the moon in a very different mode than we did in the 70s and in the late 60s and 70s. As Mal said, the last people to walk on the moon did so in 1972, and the last three Apollo missions were canceled after that. So, but now things have changed. Now there's other entities, companies, private companies, that are capable or will be very shortly of going to the moon, which relieves some of the burden from NASA to own big rockets to get us there, so they can focus more on perhaps the science of the moon, which seems silly because it's the closest astronomical body to us. But it frees up NASA and its experts to focus more on the science. There's a lot to be learned from the moon, even though we think we know it well. There's still a lot of things that we can learn from our closest neighbor in space. And also, as Mal indicated, it's perhaps a good jumping off point for missions deeper into the solar system.
So, Nicole, picking up on what John just said, what don't we know about the moon already? I mean, from a pure layperson perspective, you know, we've been there. It looks like a lot of gray dust. It's dry. It just doesn't seem like that exciting a place.
Yeah, so the more we look at the moon, the more weird stuff we keep finding.
Really?
So the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been in orbit since, I think, 2009, has been mapping crater densities, new craters on the moon, because it orbits over the same location every few months or years, and so it can see new stuff. Signatures of water was a new thing from lunar exploration. And there's a lot that we can learn about the early history of the solar system because it's bound up in that cratering record. So because the moon is essentially geologically dead, it's preserved its surface for several billion years.
I see.
Those crater densities can tell us a lot about the relative ages of the surface. By using radioactive dating of moon rocks that are brought back, we get absolute ages of the surface, and learn a lot about how the solar system formed.
So it's like a historical record for us to look at.
Yeah, yeah, our time capsule. Yeah.
Let's take a call. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email with your questions and comments for our astronomy crew, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. From Nottingham, Steve is on the air. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. I have been obsessed with the moon landing since because Wade, you haven't mentioned this, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of that first moon landing. And I think that was one of the central events of my life when we had left this planet and went into something beyond the Earth. And so I want to emphasize that. And I'm going to ask a really duck question. I remember, first of all,
no duck question, Steve.
Are there golf balls still on the moon? And I saw the tracks and the footprints. Are they still there on the moon?
Well, that is a great question. It is not a duck question, Mal, because, you know, maybe it's windy on the moon and the footprints got swept away. I don't know.
Oh, no, it's not windy on the moon. That's for sure.
Okay.
You need air to have wind.
You need
an
atmosphere.
I didn't even think about that.
So there's no atmosphere. So it's a lousy place to go for dinner. But I don't know where that came from. I'm sorry. But in any case, as far as the golf ball goes, my guess is it's probably melted by now.
Melted? Hang on.
Because
is it warm on the moon?
It's very hot. It's 200-something degrees in the direct sunlight.
250 in the sun and minus 200 in the shade. So it's big temperature swing.
And so are the footprints still there?
Oh, the footprints are still there.
To answer Steve's
question? Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, we've seen them with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter images. Tracks from footprints. We've seen the leftovers of the landers. We've seen tracks from the rovers. LRO was the first camera that gave us that resolution on the moon. So we can still see that.
Okay, so Steve, it's not a duck question at all. I learned something just from the answer that you all gave. So that's great. Don, did you want to jump in on that too?
No.
Okay. Mal?
If I could just add something as far as the moon landings go. Thinking back to Apollo, and the question was, is there more we can find out about the moon?
Right.
Well, I believe there must be because think about what there were six missions that landed successfully on the moon, and we spent a total out of those six missions about 80 hours walking on the moon, bringing home some samples from just six selected spots on the moon.
Not very extensive.
Do we know a lot about the moon just from landing? It's like landing an alien trying to land on the Earth at six separate spots on the Earth, spending 80 hours maybe roaming around and bringing samples back.
And saying,
does
I got
that
it
tell
all
you
figured
you
out.
Know you got right. it all figured out?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So I wanted to point out that Steve mentioned something. It's coming up on the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. And I know that PBS is working on a show that is produced by PBS called American Experience. And they're working on a three-part, two-hour-each session, three-part special called Chasing the Moon, which will air sometime in 2009. And I'm just 2019, and this year, and later toward the summertime. And that show is being worked on right now. And it's going to focus on not only the moon landings themselves, but the whole culture, the Cold War, the quest to get to the moon first. It's going to be an interesting miniseries.
So, Steve, thank you for not only asking the question, but raising the anniversary. We really appreciate the call. Go ahead, Nicole.
Can I also complain, as the millennial in the room, that there has not been any moon landings in my lifetime?
Nicole wants
really
a moon landing.
I really want to see people on the moon. That's it. Come on, guys.
Well, we can't forget about Elon Musk going to the moon, which we talked about on our last show, right? Sending a spaceship with seven artists.
Yes.
Not going to land, but going to orbit around the moon.
That's right.
Right? We talked about that.
Yeah,
in
the
last
very, very wealthy Japanese entrepreneur
Nicole wants
who invited.
Yes.
I
know she wants a landing, but hey.
I cried at the Apollo exhibit at the Kennedy Space Center when I was 16 because it affected me so much. But I haven't seen any of it in real time. That's super sad.
But at least you believe that we landed on the moon.
Steve, thank you so much for that call. And a couple other questions from our listeners about all these lunar topics that we're covering. But then I do want to let everybody know we are going to talk about New Horizons because that has got the world of space science just with its hair on fire in excitement. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But Jamie from Brisbane, Australia. Okay, so we're streaming everywhere, always.
It's a little after midnight.
A little after midnight. So Jamie is obviously listening online. He emailed to ask, will Australians get the same great view of the lunar eclipse that we talked about earlier? And when, John?
I don't believe they're going to see the eclipse. I'll check right now, but the eclipse will not be visible in Australia.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, Jamie.
Okay. But, Jamie, it's really actually kind of cool to hear from you. So keep listening online.
We'll send him pictures of our snowstorm.
Right. Marcus sent us an email. China has expressed interest in extracting helium-3 from lunar regolith for use in fusion energy.
That's a good point, right? That's a good point. It didn't dawn on me, but helium-3, of course, nobody has a viable fusion reactor today. I'm kind of wondering why we don't put more research funds into developing fusion as a source of generating electricity, but it's finally starting. I know MIT is very heavily involved in some efforts to do a break-even point fusion reaction so that we can generate electricity instead of using fission. A lot of advantages for fusion. It's the same source of energy that stars use. So, but to explain the helium-3 connection, helium-3 would be a great fuel for nuclear fusion, and the moon has some, as the Earth does in water. We can find other fusionable materials in seawater, but helium-3 is available in the soil on the moon.
Although it seems a little more convenient to get it from the water than going all the way to the moon, but maybe that's a side benefit.
Yeah.
All right, well, Marcus, thank you for the question. Here's one from Stephen Meredith. He says, we always see one side of the moon, which means that our mechanics are aligned in a particular way. Here's Steve's question. I love this question. Are there other moons that share those same mechanics around other planets, or are we unusually unique? Steve, I never thought about that before. Thank you so much. Mal?
Yes. The answer is yes. If you talk about most of the moons, most of them are in I guess you have to introduce a term here. It's called synchronous rotation. And what that means is as our moon goes around the Earth, the reason it keeps the same face facing us all the time is because it's actually rotating just like the Earth rotates.
I see. Synchronous
so
with us.
If you walked in a circle, a way to do this is get somebody to stand up and pretend that they're the Earth, and you walk around them, but don't turn around and not face them. And you'll be going sideways, if you can picture this, around that person with you face on to them. And in the process of doing that, you will actually rotate one turn. So that if you go to the Galilean moons in Jupiter, for example, if on a good night through a good telescope, you can make out these four moons Galileo discovered. They all do a synchronous rotation. I think most of the others do. Nicole can probably back me up on that.
Yeah, I think so, because most of the moons are much, much smaller than the planets that host them. So the planet's gravity dominates and causes it to face that one side.
Well, yeah. I never thought about that before.
It's a good question. A lot of moons orbiting close to a large planet are in sync, are locked gravitationally. Even Pluto's moon Charon is gravitationally locked with it, which was observed by New Horizons when it flew by Pluto. So,
right.
Yes, it's not unique in the solar system.
Great questions from our listeners in Meredith, New Hampshire, and Brisbane, Australia. Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, all of you, another huge, huge story in astronomy just recently has to do with New Horizons, the NASA spacecraft going way out into the Kuiper Belt. That's like way out in the Pluto neighborhood and beyond. This has got so many people excited, and there's a lot to talk about. One of the people who was very excited about it is Queen guitarist Brian May. He wrote a song about this called Ultima Thule. Did you know Brian May has a doctorate in astrophysics? And was a contributing scientist to the New Horizons project. I did not know that until yesterday. but here we go. Let's just hear a little bit from Brian May's song. It's called Ultima Thule Mix.
Never.
All right, okay. Control yourselves, everybody.
Wow. So there you have it.
Dance party in the studio.
It's a good thing you can't see what's going on here, really.
So Queen guitarist Brian May, Nicole, writing a song about Ultima Thule, about New Horizons. Why are people, including Brian May, who, by the way, has a beautiful head of hair on him. Why are they so excited about this?
So fun story, I think, about him in general. He was working on his graduate degree when the band made it big, and so it was interrupted by his
musical
career.
So he had to set it aside.
He went back.
Okay.
Yeah, which is awesome. Yeah, so this is the furthest object that we've visited, and it was only just discovered in 2014. So long after New Horizons had been on its way and was almost to Pluto, they finally found an object that was along its trajectory after Pluto that it could see. So this object is part of the Kuiper Belt, as you mentioned. It looks like a little snowman.
So it's cute.
You want to build a snowman is stuck in my head already. And it's a contact binary, which is why it looks like a snowman. There's like a big spherical piece and a little spherical piece. But it's really good evidence for something. And because we were all very excited on Twitter about this, astronomer James Tuttle Keane was talking about this on Twitter, how it's evidence of something called pebble accretion, meaning that two things in the solar system come together and they don't collide catastrophically, but they collide with such speeds relative to each other that they end up sticking together.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, that's a very important part of planet formation and not something that we can easily reproduce. So this was really exciting from that standpoint.
So how far away is it, John?
It's more than 4 billion miles from the sun.
Which is really hard to wrap your head around.
Well, yeah, it's a big number. It's far away. It takes light more than 10 hours to travel from the spacecraft back to Earth. And in fact, the data that New Horizons collected during this flyby that occurred just after midnight on New Year's Day will take about 20 months to send back to Earth. So the data rate of transmission, is really slow, and it's going to take a long time to get all the really interesting data, including other pictures, back from the spacecraft.
Well, and if people want to see a picture, our producer Jessica Hunt put up some pictures, a great web post today on our website, NHPR Exchange. And go ahead, Malik, and see if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention the data rate, the downlink from the spacecraft is slow, he said. In fact, if you remember the old dial-up internet calls you had to make, you know, when the internet first came out, this is a slower rate than that. So it takes it's really just sort of trickling information. That's why it's taking so long for it to come down.
See, it's amazing to me, Mal, that we can even get data from that far away.
True.
I mean, you know, that in and of itself, traveling so far is amazing.
Yeah.
Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange if you want to see some pictures. Jessica's put up photos and videos and so forth. There's a couple more questions that I want to ask all of you about this Ultima Thule, including, Nicole, some controversy about the name. So we'll talk about that. Also, just what we might learn from this adorable little snowman floating 4 billion miles away. So we'll talk about that after a short break. And keep taking your questions. Some great questions from listeners again this morning. exchange@nhpr.org is the email address, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a roundtable of statehouse leaders. Send us your questions. What do you want to be tops on the agenda
at the State House this year. Send us an email before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll include as many of your questions as we can. This hour, it's our Sky Crew with the latest in astronomy. And although the new year is just 2 weeks old, it started off with, pardon the pun, a big bang. I couldn't help myself, guys, but thank you for putting up with that. Couple more questions about this Ultima Thule. Again, this is this cool snowman-looking object 4 billion miles away out in the Kuiper Belt, spotted by, encountered by, however you want to put it, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft. Nicole, there's been some controversy about the name Ultima Thule. By the way, a couple people have said Ultima Thule. NASA says Thule, so we're sticking with that.
Okay.
But go ahead. What's wrong with the name? It sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, so this name was in part decided by submission and by voting by the public, which NASA does quite a lot these days so that people can have kind of a personal tie-in to the mission. And back in March, this story came out, but I don't think it got a lot of play until this year during the actual encounter. Ultima Thule is a mythological land in many different traditions. So Game of Thrones fans can kind of think of it as like north of the wall, but it usually means some cold, icy place beyond the limits of the known world. Which the Kuiper Belt totally is.
Unknown, cold, and icy.
Yeah, so it's super poetic, and so that was a really popular choice. Unfortunately, the term was also co-opted by the Nazis in their kind of mythological speakings of the origin of the Aryan race, and it's still used by neo-Nazis and white supremacists today. So anything that makes neo-Nazis happy, I feel like, maybe not the best idea for a naming.
So is NASA going to rename this thing?
So the International Astronomical Union is the only body that can officially name these things.
Oh, okay.
Ultima Thule was just a nickname along the way. Anyway, a lot of these objects are given nicknames, but then have to be ratified by the IAU. But this, I think, is going to hit a lot more controversy, as this has been discussed quite a bit amongst the space and science communication community, in that maybe it's not a good idea to give it a name that makes neo-Nazis happy in this current political climate. There's a great Twitter thread by Dr. Suzanne Wertheim. She's a linguistic anthropologist who specializes in the expressions of bias in language. And she has a great thread up about how using Ultima Thule is not a reclamation, as some people on the team have stated, because it's not being reclaimed by a group that was oppressed by the use of the term. And that it's really unfortunate that such a cool, awesome term has been co-opted, but maybe we should look somewhere else for a name.
I disagree completely. I think to give a short duration in the history of mankind the power to remove a perfectly named object is ridiculous. I'm just so strongly opposed to that. Let the 50-year usage of that by the Nazis die along with that mindset. Because this name of this mythological place is thousands of years old as the Roman Empire. And, you know, humans have been nasty to each other for our entire history. You know, there's going to be bad guys all the time. This is a perfectly named object. And as Nicole said, it's not an official name. It's just that the science team got sick of calling it 2014 MU69.
Which isn't very appealing.
You know, it contains a lot of information for astronomers. But if you want to get the public energized and inspired by exploring the limits of our solar system, an object that's 29 kilometers long at the furthest extents of our solar system, let's pick something that's representative of where it is, a cold, dark place in the solar system.
Well, I'm going to set that debate aside and let people on Twitter hash it out, but turn to you, Mal Cameron, and ask you about a local connection to this endeavor out in the Kuiper Belt.
Absolutely. I discovered there's next door to my town, in the town of Nottingham, there is a gentleman. His name is Craig Wirth, and Wirth is spelled W-E-R-T-H, and he is a singer and songwriter who caught the attention of the group of the New Horizons team. Back when it was flying past Pluto is when it started, because he wrote a song called Isn't It Amazing? And he had a lot of space stuff in there and talking about that mission in particular. He got invited to go to Maryland at the Johns Hopkins Center down there where the team who keeps track of New Horizons is. And he wrote a song specifically about Pluto and more recently about its trip past Ultima Thule. And so he was down there and he got everybody in the room, who all the scientists and stuff who were keeping track of it, to sing along with him in a little song called Isn't It Amazing.
And if anybody says that, you know, space scientists can't sing, we've got the proof right here.
Yes, we do.
They can. So let's just hear a little bit. This is singer-songwriter Craig Wirth from Nottingham, New Hampshire, writing a song, as you said, Mal, that caught the attention of NASA. And here he is singing along with the New Horizons Mission Control Center staff.
Isn't it amazing? All the ones who came before, isn't it amazing? How they opened up the doors, isn't it amazing? Every woman, every man, on whose dreams and work we stand. It is amazing, I am amazed. It is amazing, I am amazed.
Okay, so they sound pretty good there. That's the New Horizons Mission Control Center staff. Maybe only the people who really like to sing decided to join Craig Wirth from Nottingham, but that's great. Anything else, guys, on New Horizons? I mean, my goodness, it's done so much already. John, is it planning to go anywhere else?
Well,
does it come home now? I mean, it's 4 billion miles away.
No, it's never coming home. Certainly not enough fuel to do that. No reason to do that. It's the mission is funded through 2021, and the team is actually planning on continuing to explore this vast region that Pluto is only one of the closest emissaries of, the Kuiper Belt. If you can imagine a donut with a hole in the middle, that's where all the sun is located and all the major planets. But out beyond the donut, in the same plane as the donut, we have this vast group of objects, and that's the Kuiper Belt. So they're small, icy, and not modified, not altered by the radiation of the sun because they're so far away. So they represent early contents of the solar system. And that's why we're so interested in exploring this part of the solar system.
And that's why Craig Wirth appropriately says, it is amazing.
It is.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Bob is calling from Lee. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hello. I was wondering about the federal shutdown, whether that's going to interfere with the collection of data, like from New Horizons. If the phone's home and nobody's there, what happens? And I also understand that the Hubble is in trouble, but they can't do anything about it right now because of the shutdown.
Wow, that's a great question, Bob. And I like the way he puts it, Nicole. If, you know, one of these spacecrafts phones home and nobody's there, what do you do with that? You were at a big, big meeting, the American Astronomical Society, AAS, largest gathering of astronomers and astrophysicists just recently. How did the government shutdown affect that meeting?
Yeah, so the AAS meeting in Seattle was one of the largest on record with over 3,000 attendees. However, about 10 to 15% of the attendees couldn't come because they were furloughed, considered non-essential personnel. They are not only not working, they're not allowed to work. And these are people who love their jobs. So not being allowed to work, check their email, do any of that is kind of frustrating. Now, people that are getting signals back from New Horizons, they're either going to be contractors, which do still have money, or they're considered essential personnel. So they're working without pay. They don't let a spacecraft wander the solar system, thankfully, without somebody home to take care of it.
Sure, because it's expensive to put these
yes.
out there. So it would be a
yes.
complete waste of money to
yes.
have them sending back data
yes.
and not
nobody home.
Collect it. What else, though? I mean, the broader implications mm-hmm. of this prolonged shutdown
sure.
on NASA research and the research that it does with contractors. Nicole, but I'd love to hear from everybody on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, NASA and the National Science Foundation are where we get most of our astronomy funding. NASA does space-based things, and
NSF does the ground-based things. And with those two shut down, in a lot of ways, it actually has a huge trickle-down effect through the rest of science. So you have federal workers who are furloughed or who are working without pay. You have contractors who are not working and in some cases will never be paid back like those federal workers will be. The NASA town hall, there's always a town hall that talks about the funding situation about from NASA and the National Science Foundation at the big AAS meeting. The NASA one got canceled. The James Webb Space Telescope town hall got canceled. The National Science Foundation town hall didn't have to be canceled because the person who's doing that's not a contractor. It's a rotating position of university scientists, but he couldn't travel to the meeting. And so they did it remotely, and there was like a half hour delay.
Oh, interesting.
Due to some technical difficulties. So it slowed that down. Now, a lot of us that do research are funded by NASA and the NSF. And we have an NSF grant at St. Anselm for doing some cool stuff. But if NASA's not open, we can't apply for the funding. The longer the shutdown goes on, the more difficult that gets for everyone. In addition,
that's okay.
There's a few things.
There are a lot of implications, backlogs and immediate implications like important scientists not being able to attend this meeting,
right,
share ideas, but then backlogs in terms of funding and research and so forth.
Yeah. So what the caller mentioned was that Hubble's Wide Field Camera 3 is having issues. And I don't know too much about the details of it. They were hoping it was a software issue and that a restart would fix it. But I think the people who can fix it are furloughed.
They're
and
furloughed.
So,
yes, that is true.
They can't actually do that right now. Now, there are other cameras on Hubble that are working, so they're just going to, you know, kind of change around the observing schedule.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but if you have time on that instrument and it's down because of a government shutdown, strictly for political reasons, this is a huge impediment to science. And to have employees of the federal government working without being paid is just un-American.
Now, when you said if you have time on that space telescope, what does that mean,
John? Let's say if you want to study a distant galaxy that uses a particular instrument on the Hubble Space Telescope, of which there are many.
So university scientists like rent time on the Hubble?
Well, they write a proposal. It gets reviewed by the Space Telescope Science Institute, and several are, you know, many are selected, but many are rejected.
I think it's a 10% acceptance rate. It's really hard.
It's hard to get time because it's in demand, right?
I see.
It's the instrument that scientists and astronomers use that has the biggest record of papers written from data collected by that instrument. So if you have time and your object needs the Wide Field Camera 3 and it's down, tough luck. You miss your window and you have to reapply.
And you spent maybe years working on that proposal
and so forth. You know, we're talking about a very narrow segment of government workers, those involved with science. But it's simply ridiculous.
Bigger ripple effects for science, as
it's
we're
huge.
Hearing. Mal, did you want to jump in? Effects of the shutdown on NASA, science, or the scientists like Nicole rely on that?
There are some ground-based observatories in their arsenal as well that are in danger of being shut down. Some of them are already, they're funded perhaps into the end of this month or maybe sometime into February. But if this goes on beyond that point, there'll be a lot of other ramifications here on Earth, not just with the Hubble.
All right. Well, a couple more minutes left, and there's a couple more things I did want to pivot to with all of you. And John Jean Forty, to you first. You keep track of us here on this show for so-called exoplanets. These are planets outside our own solar system. And whenever these are discovered, people get all excited. You know, can we move there? Can we go there? Are there little green men and women there? but just recently, citizen scientists discovered an exoplanet that they said was potentially habitable. So what about that?
Well, there's been several planets that have used the NASA Kepler data sent back down to Earth from the Kepler spacecraft, which was launched in 2009. And that data is made available through a number of citizen scientist portals. One of them is Planet Hunters. And the planet recently discovered, the exoplanet recently discovered, was the result of a Kepler-2. Kepler has had some malfunctions, had a three-year lifespan, but it lasted quite a bit longer than that through some ingenious reprogramming of the mission that allowed the spacecraft to continue to search for extrasolar planets and also study stars. And this was the K2 mission, the rebirth of the Kepler spacecraft. That's where the data for this latest exoplanet. And it's just another example of how citizens with an interest in science can make discoveries, in this case, of planets orbiting other stars. And this one wasn't that far away, only about 370 light years. Now, yes, that's far distance-wise, but it's in the solar neighborhood.
Farther than Ultima Thule, though, that we talked about earlier.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes.
Nicole, speaking of citizen scientists, from what I understand, you are working to train the next generation of citizen scientists. What are you up to?
Well, one of the things I presented at the AAS was a study of motivations of citizen scientists. Although my PhD is in astronomy, I also do education research. I look at what gets people jazzed about helping us do science, essentially as a volunteer effort. We're working through that right now. But this project in particular, one of the main reasons people join citizen science projects, according to our interviews, is that they want to make an impact in science. They want to discover something cool. And this is a case where they discovered something cool. The Exoplanet Explorer project is currently available if you want to jump on. They're looking at this Kepler-2 data discovering, in this case, a planet about twice the size of Earth in the star's habitable zone.
So citizen scientists can discover
Absolutely. Exoplanets.
They've named comets, right? They've mm-hmm. named stars.
Vorwerps. Hanny's Vorwerp was an actual gaseous blob that was named after a citizen scientist.
He was Dutch.
Yes. So I see. Okay.
Yes.
You read the expression
means,
on my face.
It means object.
Okay. Well, all of you, a couple things we left on the table. We'll have to talk about it next time. I really appreciate everybody coming in. And Mal Cameron, it was great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. John Gianforte, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
John Gianforte, director of the UNH Observatory and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And Nicole Gallucci, thank you also for being here. Really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. Again, our website is nhpr.org/exchange. Check it out especially today because we've got some great photos and videos and so forth for you to enjoy. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.